The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think, and many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream, then actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect. All are humble and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Well, welcome to this edition of What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dawe. We're thrilled today to have Mark Tirsik with us. Mark is an advisor to companies, investors, NGOs, and businesses on environmental strategies that make business sense. He's best known perhaps as the former CEO of the Nature Conservancy, which is the world's largest environmental nonprofit with revenues of about $1 billion, a million members, and they do fantastic work in more than 70 countries around the world. He's a former partner and managing director at Goldman Sachs, and he's the founder of The Instigator, which is intended to be a medium that's sort of a place for thought-provoking ideas to help tackle difficult environmental challenges. So Mark, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
So give us the download. How did you get here?
Well, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, in an immigrant working class neighborhood right in the city. It was a good place to grow up. The big takeaway from that was work ethic, for better or worse. So my parents raised me to have a work ethic. So then after college, I went to Japan. I'd never been abroad, so that was important for me. I got into finance at the most junior level. I concluded it was obvious I didn't know enough, so I went to Harvard Business School, which I really enjoyed. I was very fortunate. And there, by that time, I had concluded I like to work with smart people who also worked hard, solving big problems in a kind of entrepreneurial way and in a global way. And that took me to Goldman Sachs. Back in 1984, Wall Street was very different then. For me, it was one of those right time, right place things. I mean, I worked hard. I hope I did a good job, but the firm really grew subsequent to 1984. So I had the good fortune at Goldman to lead some important businesses. And so although I started as a deal guy, that was fun. And that's why I went there. I ended up being more of a leader and manager. So then as a leader and manager, after about 20 years of that, I started to think, hey, I could do something besides investment banking. And so thinking about that, thinking about my interest in environmental challenges, aware of my positive view of business. I even back then, I had the clear view that business could be a force for good and problem solving. That I almost left Goldman Sachs to pursue being an environmentalist. My boss at the time, Hank Paulson, he was the CEO of Goldman. Goldman had already gone public. He sort of swooped in. He knew more about the environmental world than me. And he said, "I don't think your idea is that good, Mark. I have a better idea. Build an environmental effort for Goldman Sachs." So this was back in 2005. Today, it's very conventional for most big companies, including Wall Street firms, to have very advanced and ambitious environmental efforts. In 2005, it was almost avant-garde. And it's Hank, not me, who deserves the credit for having that idea. Right after that, this was late 2005, Hank went to be Secretary Treasurer for President Bush. But Lloyd Blankfein, Hank's successor, supported me. And our simple idea was first for Goldman, and then for our clients, we would look for opportunities to address environmental problems in a way that was also good for the bottom line. And that has been my core idea ever since, really. And it turned out, in my view, to be easy at Goldman Sachs to do that. You know, it took some hustle and you had to take some chances. And it also seemed pretty easy to do that on behalf of clients. So then one day a headhunter called me. Definitely not to recruit me, definitely. A headhunter called me because this is what you do. I was the head of Goldman Sachs environmental strategies. And so a headhunter called me and said, "Hey, you know everybody in space. We're doing a search for the next CEO of the Nature Conservancy. Do you have anybody you'd like to nominate?" And I said, you bet I do. So I nominated myself. Everyone thought I was crazy. All my friends in the environmental world said, they're never going to hire a Goldman banker. And I said, well, that may be, but I'll learn a lot from this experience. And then I did something smart. I mean, not to brag. It's not really bragging, but just goes with my humble origins in Cleveland and what I learned at Goldman Sachs. I really hustled. So there was no stone that I didn't turn over in pursuing that Goldman Sachs job. I mean, I'm sorry, the Nature Conservancy job. And so then you could kind of tell at first when they were interviewing me, they were just being polite. And it got better and better. And lo and behold, I got the job. So I ran TNC for 11 years. It was a huge team effort. First of all, the people who work at TNC are great, smart, driven, entrepreneurial, great people. If anybody deserves credit for the things we accomplished while I was the boss, it's all of them. We also had great partners, great supporters. You know, nonprofits are amazing. So for 11 years, I did that. And then it was a hard job, though, a really kind of exhausting job. So after 11 years, I stepped down. And then you described what I'm doing now. I'm trying to advise private sector leaders on the same kind of thing. So sorry, that was long-winded, but that is how I got here. I feel very fortunate. And I'll say, as I think back on that, I deserve some credit. I mean, as I said in that one example, I hustled. I took full advantage, I think, of opportunities I had. But I was really fortunate because every step along the way, and I left a lot out, really kind people chose to help me. You know, I asked for help. I always did that. I asked for mentors. It also dawns on me now, I got a lot of help from the junior people who worked for me. So I'm really grateful for all that help I've received. I still receive it. And so at this stage of my life, I also try to help back, give back, and mentor and advise others to the best I can.
Well, that's an incredible journey. Just in, you know, hearing that described. So I got to back up a little bit there. And, you know, I feel like to some extent, people that are keenly interested in the environment are somewhat skeptical of the intentions of business to really provide help. And, you know, you made a transition from, you know, one of the biggest and best investment banks in the world, you know, the center of capitalism, to the largest environmental nonprofit. And did you face any skepticism along the way as to sort of who you were?
Yeah. No, skepticism every step of the way. And it's appropriate. You know, life's complex, right? And business doesn't always get it right. Even the best and most well-intentioned businesses don't always get it right. And there are also bad actors in the business world. So I would say a couple of things about that. First, we shouldn't have complete confidence in business. We need great government leadership and great government policy most of all. And you need strong regulations and you need to enforce them to ensure business does the right thing. So I like to emphasize that right up front, because business leadership is never a substitute for the governmental and regulatory leadership we need. A second thing I would say is the skeptics about business do a great service. You know, for example, I mean, it's almost funny. Sometimes an organization like Greenpeace or the Rainforest Action Network, both very able, kind of left-leaning business skeptics, campaigning organizations, would go after a company for doing something not quite right, scare the bejesus out of the leadership team because they were such effective campaigners, and they'd have a change of heart and end up partnering with an organization like the Nature Conservancy. And net, 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 it was a great outcome, but you needed those campaigners and those skeptics up front. So in the environmental world, perhaps in all worlds addressing societal challenges, but in the environmental world, I would say there's room for every strategy. It's always appropriate to have skeptics and critics. At the Nature Conservancy, we had a lot of critics, and they were good people. They wanted what we wanted, better environmental outcomes. And I would always say to our team, therefore, our critics are our friends. Let's not be defensive. Let's be super transparent. Let's pay close attention. If they find some reason to criticize us, that will be good to know, because then if they're right, we can improve our behavior. So I think that's my broad take. It's not always easy. It's, of course, when you're criticized, sometimes the criticism's not right and you want to be defensive, or sometimes it's delivered with a little bit of extra, you know, venom and vilification. I think it'd be better if it was less often that way. But broadly, there's room for everybody's perspective. Nobody should think they have all the answers. I think everybody should be pretty humble too, even when things are going well. I've had this experience. Even when things are going very well, that doesn't mean everything is. And so that would be kind of my two cents about all that. But remember, there are some things that business is really good at when they're at their best. Like, we just had this COVID crisis, and I happen to be immune compromised. I'm okay right now. But so when COVID started, my personal situation was scary. My doctor said, until this goes away or until there are vaccines, you can't do anything. You can't take any risk. The reason I mentioned that is we didn't know if there would be vaccines or under what time frame or how good they would work. And so I was thinking, wow, this is going to be really tough for me. I might have to hunker down for an extended period of time. And then lo and behold, these big companies working together with, you know, academics and scientists and the government, but really leading the charge, these big companies came up with vaccines that are game changers. And that's the sort of thing big business can do when it's at its best. It can harness capital. It can move fast. It can use technology. It can do big things. And by the way, solving environmental problems requires those attributes. Now, what can we all do? We can all push business leaders, therefore, to behave in that most enlightened way. They don't always do it, but it seems to me we should encourage them as much as we can, and it can provide a lot of upside.
Mark, how do you then, you know, align to what you've said? You've been in this drive and this campaigning for many decades, yeah? How do you kind of square up, I guess, link to Mike's point, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it in a company. You know, everything's going smoothly. They're outputting what they're outputting. They're making the profits that they are. So there may be this lip service. Do you find yourself, you know, you're kind of banging your head against the wall, or is that getting easier as the years get better?
I'm not banging my head against the wall. And I don't think most of this is lip service. Doesn't mean business always does everything they say they will do, but a couple of reactions. First, there were a lot of people like me trying to get business to be more aware of environmental challenges, the downside of not addressing them, and the upside of doing so. And so it's a long list of people that includes, you know, I started doing it at Goldman, but there were NGOs on both sides, pro-business, anti-business, academics, writers, and journalists. So all of those people, it's like a big global tribe. They don't always agree with one another. I think I'm one of the members. We all, I think, deserve a little bit of credit for hanging in there and pushing this theme, because it's obviously really caught on. I mean, you pick up the business paper any day today, and you know, businesses and investors get it. Now, why does it have more momentum today than it did? Well, it takes a while for any big new thing to happen. But more importantly, awareness of environmental challenges has really soared, not for good reasons, because, you know, fires, climatic, you know, really disastrous weather events, droughts, I mean, you name it. These bad things, of course, get the attention of business leaders. But other things have happened too. The world has changed. There's transparency like never before. That's why I pushed back on the lip service thing. You would have to really be a stupid business leader today to try to fool the public. Like this, you know, they used to have this concept, greenwashing, where a company would say one thing nice about the environment and not really, it would just be BS. Well, today that's a really foolish strategy, because there is like so much transparency, you're not gonna get away with it. Another thing that is exciting today is people have agency. So like when I joined Goldman Sachs in 1984, it was expected that I would keep my head down, work hard, and like not raise a fuss. Today, young people raise a fuss. They speak up and their leaders listen to them. Even recruits speak up. So many CEOs have told me one reason we need to really get good at this sort of thing is because we can't recruit the people we want to recruit otherwise. Customers speak up. Investors speak up. So all of these stakeholders are coming together to encourage business leaders to do the right thing. That matters. Further, business leaders are generally pretty good at in managing risk. Otherwise, you know, you won't be successful. They look ahead. They see so much risk. So they want to be smart about that. And then finally, they see opportunity to grow their top line with new strategies addressing environmental problems. So actually, I think it's the laggard business leader who's not doing this thing. I've been at this now for almost 20 years. I've never come across a business yet that doesn't have the opportunity to do important and positive environmental things in a way that that will also strengthen business mm-hmm. outcomes. So yeah. I think the change is real. I think it will endure. It doesn't mean it addresses all of our problems and challenges, but it's, of course, a huge step in the right direction.
Mark, just to build on that, then, you seem to have a pretty holistic view of both the opportunity and the responsibility for all parties to kind of come to the table and play a part, whether that's, you know, the corporate world, governments, NGOs, even individuals.
Yep.
What has changed, you know, that you feel like has opened the door to that? You know, you talked a bit about awareness, but and also maybe agency. What do you feel like has enabled that or empowered it?
Oh, well, that may be a question outside my expertise. Like, I'm not a social scientist or political scientist. Transparency is a big part of it. And I think the internet, I really am not the right guy to answer that question. I think everybody listening to this podcast will agree. Transparency is way up. Like, there aren't very many secrets anymore in life. That's a good thing. And people have this agency. You see it in other social causes too, which, again, not my area of professional focus, but I care. But like Black Lives Matter, you see, you know, bad events happen. People step up and act. They get the world's attention. And of course, we have a long way to go. I don't want to be Pollyannish, but it's different than it used to be. So that's part of it. And then specifically in the environmental area, there's just, it's a shame it took so long. It's really a shame, but there's better awareness today of how grave these environmental challenges are. There's also better awareness today of how much business upside there is in addressing them. Or another way to put it, like it used to be, we would talk about this, the strategies to address environmental problems, and opponents would say, oh, but they're so expensive. And it is true that there is a cost to addressing these problems. But I would say back then, but today I think everybody, not everybody, but more people understand it. It's true there's a cost to addressing these problems, but there's a much higher cost, much higher, of not addressing them. Again, that's where business people are helpful, because they're not generally idealistic or ideologues. Rather, they run the numbers. This is what business people do. They run the numbers and they say, oh, yes, there's a cost of making this investment, and there's a much higher cost of not making an investment. Therefore, we will raise the money we need and make the investment. That's what business people do. That kind of no BS, realistic way of thinking about the future is really helpful to bring into the discussion of all the above. Governments are not as good at that. It's a shame, and it will be good if we can fix it. But you see, even in the infrastructure debate today in the United States, people talk about the expense of the Biden proposal, but it's obviously not an expense. A company wouldn't account for it that way. Governments do. A company would account for that as a long-term investment. It wouldn't show up on the income statement. And then you would say, okay, how do you fund a long-term investment? You do it with long-term capital, and you judge that by the long-term IRR. And it makes it pretty easy for businesses to make investment. Government accounting doesn't work that way. Government election cycles don't work that way. So I don't mean to criticize our too hard public officials. They have a different challenge. But those are some of the areas where things have changed. And I think business can be a real driver of that. It's positive.
Mark, you talked about this holistic view, and we all agree with this and align with this. Just to help the listener here at whatever stage of leadership they are, you know, it's kind of a quick idea, a solution. I'm sure it takes a lot more time, but how does a business kind of encapsulate all the little, all the elements, all the platforms? So you talk about decarbonization, green, you talk about electric transportation, you talk about plant efficiency and even plant food. You know, yeah. I'm a food company, say, and I'm doing stuff that's non-plant, and I realize there's all these things that have tick boxes next to them. What would you say to somebody from your learning? What avenues, what baby steps should they be taking?
Yeah. I think a couple of things. It's a really interesting question. It's exactly the right question for a CEO to think about, or a leadership team. So I would say there are a couple of things. One, I mean, we've had the surge of interest in dollars flowing into ESG, which is, I think, very positive. And so a business leader should be mindful of how a company's doing, complying with the ESG checklist. And I don't use checklist in a derogatory way, but that's mostly, in my view, what ESG is right now. It's a way to, at great scale, judge companies on a whole range of behaviors. And you want to be, you know, compliant, or doing as best you can. And, you know, most companies, I think, will find they're good in some spots and have room for improvement, and others, fine, then just come up with a program for improvement. But that kind of compliance, that's not the pathway to excellence or making a really powerful, positive contribution. That requires more work. That requires thinking hard about your company, your assets, and your resources, where your comparative advantages, where your material, you know, what's material. So how can you do something that's really important and positive for the environment that goes beyond ESG? You know, and there's so many examples, like Walmart, famous for its brilliant supply chain management, right? They said, okay, since we're so good at supply chain management, they really are, we propose to take a gigaton of carbon emissions out of our supply chain. And they do that in part by really leaning hard on their suppliers, because let's face it, that's what Walmart is famous for and good for. I think that makes a lot of sense. At the other end of the spectrum, you have a company like Intuit, which is basically a software company, right? A great one. So they said recently, hey, we should be net zero. And then somebody else, I'm not an insider here, so this is just my understanding, but I think this is about right. And I admire what they've done. I think somebody else at Intuit said, look, we're a software company. Our carbon footprint's small. It's easy for us to be net zero. We should do something more important, but it should be something that makes business sense. So then this is really cool, I think. They announced this thing 50 by 30. And so what they mean by that is they take the Intuit carbon footprint before they announced this, they multiply that by 50. So that's the amount of carbon reduction they want to achieve by 2030. And the way they do that is they work with their customers, who are often medium-sized and smaller companies for whom these fancy climate strategies are difficult. And they make it easy for them to reduce their emissions. You say, well, that seems to me pretty smart. It's a really positive thing for the environment. And it probably is also really positive for their business. So it will grow and grow. So there's no like glib answer, but this is what business leaders are paid to do. Think hard about your comparative advantage. Think hard about where you can do something that's material and important, and come up with a strategy. And then one more thing. This CEOs used to get wrong, but I think now they know the world is changing. Listen to your stakeholders. Employees, even junior ones, want to be heard. Your customers want to be heard. Your investors want to be heard. Create little forums by which you can do that. You'll have much more engagement, which will be great for your business, but you'll also get good ideas that you otherwise won't get. You know, even me, when I look back at TNC, I wish I had done more of that. You know, you can't do everything. But when I look back, I said, you know, I would have been a better CEO if I had done more of that. So it's always good to keep learning. But those would be my big things for companies. First, comply with an ESG framework where you're not as good as you need to be. Don't be embarrassed. Be transparent, but come up with a plan to improve. Second, come up with a material strategy to do something important, but also makes business sense. And third, listen to your stakeholders. Make it easy for them to be heard. You know, like junior employees, it's not easy for them to be heard. So go out of your way to make it easy. Those would be my couple of pieces of advice.
Fascinating.
Fantastic, Mark. So kind of building on that then, I think what we've witnessed in the past year or so is companies stepping into an interesting role that sometimes has been played by government. And you know, as the prior administration in the U.S. had started to roll back environmental regulations, it was interesting to see that there were also, you know, even a corporate backlash to it. Even companies saying, hey, wait a minute, this isn't the direction that we need to go in. We see that also on social issues, that companies are beginning to step in. It's a topic that you've written about eloquently. Why do you think companies are doing that, and you know, what's changed maybe from the past?
Yeah, this is something I've thought a lot about, including when I was at TNC, and I've written about it in my newsletter. Can I plug it? My newsletter, The Instigator, is on Substack. Please subscribe. It's free, and I work hard at it. Anyway, I would say the big thing, guys, that CEOs and leaders have to think about is, when should we speak up on kind of societal issues, including the environment, but perhaps Black Lives Matter or voting rights? When should we speak up and when not? How to think about that? And then maybe even more importantly, I think even more importantly, when should we fight and push and lobby for the government policy we need? Let's talk about that first. So again, at the very start of this discussion, I said government policy is ultimately the most important thing we need. And it's been very frustrating on the environmental front, but also on many other fronts. We haven't been doing well getting the policy we need, in my view. I suppose people can debate that. And it's not just a US challenge either. And then, like, what else do we know? Oh, we do know everybody complains, not everybody, many people complain about there being too much money in business and too much corporate lobbying, which I think is probably true. So then you have these companies who are saying, hey, we want to do the right thing about the environment, blah, blah, blah. Maybe they're even doing the right thing about the environment even better. And so what we have to ask those leaders then is, or push them if they don't just voluntarily choose to do it. If you say you're for a price on carbon, say, as a climate policy, then we think you're obliged when you do your other lobbying to push for that. And I think it will really make a huge difference if that happens. And it is beginning to change. It's hard to know what's really happening because that's happening in behind closed doors on Capitol Hill. But I used to ask the senators I knew, I live here in Washington, D.C., and they used to tell me, Mark, it's not happening. Your favorite companies who are doing all this good thing, when they come see us, they're not talking about climate policy. And so I went to those favorite companies of my mind and I asked them and they said, "Ah, you're right." You know, privately, they said to me, "You're right. We'll do more." And recently, there's been some public good evidence, I think, that companies are doing more. But I think we have some ways to go there. So the best companies, I hope, will push for the policies that we need. I think it is a little bit complicated for them. They've got a variety of things they want to bring to regulators' attention. This is one more. But anyway, that's right. We're asking them to put one more on the list. And then, you know, companies really dread getting involved in these partisan issues. But I don't think they have to make it partisan. At TNC, we were nonpartisan. Occasionally in the Trump era, I was criticized because I sounded like I was partisan. And I always said, sorry, you're probably right. It was hard to be nonpartisan sometimes. But I think companies can do this stuff on a nonpartisan basis, and they should. I also think it's appropriate for them to speak up on environmental issues or social issues as appropriate. I just wrote my last newsletter was on this topic. I would say this is a topic that reasonable people can disagree on. It is a little bit of a slippery slope. When should you speak up? When not? I focus more on environmental issues. And I said, look, if environmental issues are germane to your business success, and if you have serious environmental initiatives underway, and then even more, if your stakeholders really care about this stuff, I think that's a good occasion to speak up and go for it. But I say that as an environmentalist. So of course I would push them to do that. And even in response to my newsletter, some people came back and reasonably disagreed with me. So these are complicated things. None of this, you know, anybody who says this is like simple is, I think, is missing the nuance.
Yeah.
But the good news is leaders understand their stakeholders mostly want them to do more of this. It mostly makes business sense. It does require some careful thought and deliberation. But look, again, that's what business leaders are paid to do. And I'm excited and feeling positive about the progress.
Mark, how do you then, again, if this show is the What I Wish I Knew show, so how do us as leaders of businesses kind of adopt, adapt to get the most effective output of ESG, of looking after the world climate, et cetera? What steps should we be picking up that are learning moments that you have, Mark, to say, hey,
I would practice this, I might be repeating myself a little bit, but I'll reflect on my time at TNC. And so ESG, by the way, has only recently become as prominent as it is today. So while I was leading TNC broadly, to be honest, I don't think we did the comprehensive ESG review that we should have. One example would be is, in hindsight, I wish we had committed to a kind of net zero initiative. And I tried, but I didn't try my hardest because I got an enormous amount of pushback. And, you know, my colleagues who pushed back, senior people, maybe they were right. Nobody knows everything. They didn't think it was the right time for us to do that. And as a nonprofit, you have some constraints. But anyway, today I would say, go through the ESG checklist. Second, think hard about where you can make the biggest difference and have a very focused, substantive plan to do so. So at TNC, we had a very ambitious global strategic plan, and every single unit was obliged to make their maximum contribution to that plan. I think that was really good leadership by all of the leaders across TNC, supported by our board and that's important. So have a plan, have milestones to measure progress against that plan. So what I always tell organizations today is have about a 5-year plan. I think that's the right kind of time frame. Longer than that makes me nervous, but then have clear milestones year by year, so you know whether you're making progress on the plan. And you might not make the progress you expected. Fine, this is new stuff. But then if you're not, understand you're not making the progress, figure out why, as appropriate, modify the plan, but that and disclose all that. Be radically transparent about all that. And then third, I mean, I'm repeating myself, but now I'll make it more personal. Listen to your stakeholders. So, you know, one of the things at TNC that I was one of the champions of in my early days was diversity, equity, inclusion. The environmental movement still today isn't where it needs to be. And at TNC, I think we were leaders. We built a big team of professionals doing that. We invested in training. We invested in new recruiting protocols, all of which took money, which is not easy for nonprofits, and managerial attention. And then we measured it rigorously. We had an annual people survey run by an outside firm. Almost everybody participated, and it allowed us to measure how we were doing in aggregate, but also unit by unit. And as you would expect, some units would be behind, then we could intervene and try to address that. And the metrics were encouraging, so encouraging that in hindsight, I think I took my eye off the ball a little bit. It was true. All those things I just noted were true. So we could feel good about the initiatives and encouraged by the results. But what I should have done was more energetically listen to stakeholders and made it easier, especially for people who weren't happy about some of those issues, to make their case to me. I wish I had done that. I wish others on the leadership team had done that better, and it would have positioned us even better. So, you know, it's important, I think, and all these tough matters for CEOs and other leaders to be humble. Of course, measure results, be encouraged by good ones, but don't let it go to your head, and keep listening to all stakeholders. You know, for an NGO, stakeholders are first your employees, your volunteer leaders, your supporters, so donors, your government partners, your corporate partners. For companies, the stakeholders are a little bit different. Again, employees, shareholders, obviously suppliers. But the best leaders, I think, do what I just said, a broad ESG compliance and improvement where you're behind, really bold plan, rigorously monitored and transparently disclosed, and then emphasis on listening to all stakeholders and make it easy for the critics to be heard. That last part is really important.
So let's talk then about this, about the next generation that's now entering the workplace. I mean, one of the gifts often of youth is some degree of, you know, idealistic notions about what their life can turn out to be and what role they can play. What do you tell younger people kind of coming into this workforce about what they should do, what role they can play in this? Because they're, you know, most young people coming in have to find a job, and they may not always have the, you know, find their ideal job, even if they're environmentalists or, you know, motivated for social causes. What should their sort of little scorecard be, or the way that they judge who they work with?
Yeah, I love the question. I talk to young people all the time. It's exciting for me. They many young people, like, for example, kids about to graduate from college or people about to graduate from graduate programs, are hoping they can find opportunities that address environmental challenges. And I'm sure also other social challenges, but I hear from the people who want to address the environmental ones. What I generally tell them, especially soon to be college grads, is don't overthink it. Make sure you're working with people you respect. Don't work with bad people. Work with people you respect and like, and make sure your learning curve is very steep. If you have those two things, I think you've probably got a good job. You know, if you have five job offers, then you can decide which one is the best. But if you just get one, but you respect the people and you're sure the learning curve is steep, I'd say great. And then the moment one of those two things change, if you learn the people aren't so respectable or your learning curve flattens, that's the time to start looking. Then more specifically about environmental stuff, like a lot of people will come to me with a very specific idea about what they want to do, which I say, great. If you can find that opportunity, great. Like I want to work for NGO X doing work in this narrow field. But I say, remember, you know, you've got to find a job first. So I encourage people to be open-minded. And I'm often pointing out to college kids that they might say, want to work for the government or NGOs. Great if that happens. But I say, you know, the business world has great jobs too. And not just companies like Patagonia, you know, these heroic good guys, but like even Exxon right now. Exxon's undergoing, yeah, we could criticize Exxon. It's awfully late. And maybe you're even criticizing them. You don't think it's a profound enough change. But Exxon's undergoing a lot of change right now. And I think it'd be a kind of a cool place for a young person to work, to learn how to think, how you transform a company to get on the right side of climate challenges in a hurry. My point of that little anecdote is be open-minded, because it's not that obvious, in my view, where your best learning opportunity will be. And then the other thing I say, again, it harkens back to how I got my job at TNC. Hustle. Like, you've got to be well-informed. Know what you're talking about. Oh, and then finally, most importantly at all, be enthusiastic, both while looking for a job and then while at your job. The world needs enthusiasm. All this stuff we're talking about is so difficult. It can get you down in the dumps. You can lose, you know, some momentum. And so if you're especially a younger person on the team, don't cause momentum to dissipate further. Nobody needs that. Be a positive force. So even when you don't like something, express it in a positive, energetic way. That might be my most important advice. That kind of enthusiasm will take almost anyone to great heights.
Fantastic. Well, this is great stuff. So Mark, one more question. Today, are you more optimistic about environmental causes or less optimistic than you were, say, 5 years ago? And why?
Yeah. It's a kind of a tricky question. I mean, people have asked me that before. There's a reason I can be optimistic. I think it's possible for humankind at scale, by doing the right thing right away, we can adequately address many of our environmental challenges. Although, regrettably, there'll be some unfortunate harm and suffering along the way, which could have been avoided. But there's a lot we need to do, and we need to do it in a hurry. And we clearly face some headwinds. I mean, even in the US and even here in my hometown of Washington, DC, the headwinds are kind of obvious. And I don't want to be too harsh on people who aren't in complete agreement with the things I want to do either, because there are so many things society needs to do. But if we choose, or if our leaders are able to get us, you know, pulling the right levers, there's reason for optimism. But if we don't do that, there's reason for really severe pessimism. So it's not so much a question, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic? It's, you know, will humans do the right thing? Humankind writ large. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to, in my own humble way, make it more likely that society makes those proper choices. For me, the right thing to do, I think, is to draw on my two big careers, 24 years at Goldman Sachs, 11 years running TNC. I think that positions me well to be this advisor to private sector leaders on ambitious environmental problems. That's the right setup for me. Everyone will have their own kind of opportunity. If more and more people make those kinds of choices and act on that basis, then that would be a reason then to be more optimistic. I'll say one other thing about that. It's a little bit of a digression, but your question reminds me. One of the fun things for me while working at TNC, and my wife enjoyed this too, so we, of course, as CEO at a nonprofit, you've got to be very attentive to your volunteers, your donors, et cetera. And in the case of TNC, a very capital intensive nonprofit, a lot of our donors, whether big or small donors, they were older people. You know, they had reached a stage in their life when they could afford to be giving away some of their hard-earned money. Sometimes they were really rich people, sometimes like my mom, my late mom. So I spent, for the first time in my life, I spent a lot of time with people in their 80s, sometimes late 80s. And my wife, Amy, often joined me at these events and dinners and these kinds of things. And we would always say on our way home, you know, Mr. X or Miss Y, some people in their 80s, late 80s, they seemed like the most energetic, youthful, positive people we know. What's their secret? And I concluded their secret is they find a cause that they care about. They give it their all. In order to do that, they take good care of themselves too, because they want to be energetic. And then maybe the secret, real secret is they worry less about themselves and more about helping others and helping their cause. And voila, I think that's the secret of a long, positive, youthful, high energy life. So I hope people listening to this will choose in whatever way suits them to support the environmental movement or perhaps some other important movement that is better suited for them. And their reward for doing so, I think, is they'll live a happier life. So it's a pretty good deal.
Well, just on that, and it's my final question. I'm really intrigued because you mentioned earlier, and we talked a little bit about what happened in the world of the development of vaccinations through the issue and challenge of COVID and the fact that, you know, from my reflection, quite a lot of the rule books were changed or even scrapped. So, you know, innovation was faster, quicker, and through the program. You know, it's kind of an interview question, this. Let's say Mark A. Tirsek was appointed CEO of the world of sustainability, and you got nearly 8 billion people here right now. It's going to double in the next 10 or 15 years. What things would you do? What kind of top three or four things would you do being in charge of the world to help towards the drive?
It's a very good question. I'm very excited about my next career opportunity, CEO of the world. Just kidding. I think for the environmental problems that I'm focused on, climate change, protecting biodiversity, these kinds of issues, the most important things are the big, scalable, system-level changes. So I have no objection to people's voluntary initiatives, personal initiatives. I think that adds to the overall momentum, but it's the big things that we need to do. So first and foremost, we need more enlightened, smarter, self-interested government policy in the big countries with big environmental footprints. So that means the developed rich West, and that means these emerging, you know, huge countries like, you know, China and India, et cetera, Brazil, Indonesia. We need better government policy. I do think it's in the interest of the constituents of those countries to have such policy, but the politics are hard. So that's where I would start. Second, I think more of what we're seeing in the private sector. So there are some things the private sector is really good at. The vaccines were one, but you know, the extraordinary drop in the price of solar and wind energy, nobody forecast it. And then they would update the forecast. And again, all the prognosticators would be wrong. We would beat them again. And then they would update their forecast and we would beat them again. And I'll note, the private sector didn't do it all by themselves. There were some really good government policies, for example, in the US and in China to drive that. And they made sense for those two countries. Obviously, the research community helped. Everybody came together, but the private sector was important. You see it too with Elon Musk. You see it in plant-based foods. This week, as we were discussing, Tyson announced Tyson, this giant company in the traditional meat business, viewed, I think, too, as like a kind of conservative company, announces this week a suite of plant-based meat products. That's exciting. So I would say after government policy, big business. And then what can everyone do? Everyone is an employee or a customer or an investor. Everybody is some kind of stakeholder. So use your clout as a stakeholder to make this kind of change happen. Don't think for a minute, oh, there's nothing I can do. I don't buy that. but you should direct, what can you do? Direct it at these bigger, scalable, system level changes we need.
Fantastic. Well, Mark, this has been a fascinating conversation. I come away from this even more enthusiastic, maybe as a result of your enthusiasm, but also the amazing work that you've done through the years. And I think that I personally believe that, you know, some of the reason why, you know, companies are engaging in the way that they are now stems in part from the work that you and organizations like the Nature Conservancy have done. So we really appreciate your time. And for our listeners who want to get in touch with Mark, he mentioned his newsletter, The Instigator, which you can find on Substack. He's got his own website. And all you need to do is click on our website, whatiwishiknewshow.com, and we'll have the links to Mark's website and to his newsletter as well. So Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was fun speaking with you.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast, and thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.